You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, back in 2011, a video popped up. You can probably still see it over on YouTube, an Al-Qaeda spokesman. He was actually an American-born Al-Qaeda spokesman, but he was a spokesman for Al-Qaeda. Adam Yahya Gadan. And in this video, he says, and I quote, "America is absolutely awash with easily obtainable firearms. You can go down to a gun show at a local convention center and come away with a fully automatic assault rifle without a background check and most likely without even having to show an identification card. So, Al-Qaeda members, what are you waiting for?" Seriously. This is an Al-Qaeda video from 2011. So in May, the Republicans in the House Judiciary Committee voted down an amendment that would have prevented those on the terrorist watch list from buying guns. So you can't get on a plane if you're a terrorist, but you can buy a gun. And, you know, increasingly we're hearing calls from the right for not giving them lawyers. But, yeah, sure, let them buy guns. Maybe Noel Flasterstein can help us make some sense out of this. He's an attorney. He's the host of The Gun Show. GunRightsForYou.com is his website. Noel, this seems to me insane. Noel?
Insane in terms of Adam Gadan's video or... The legislator going down the proposed amendment.
It seems to me, first of all, your phone seems to be breaking up. I'm not sure if, you know, what it's got a funny noise in it. We may have to call you back. But in any case, insane in that we're saying to terrorists, no, you can't get on a plane, but yes, you can go to a gun show and buy all the guns you want. Why would we do that?
Well, I think in terms of security, when we're looking at the overall public safety of individuals that can come and go on airplanes, maybe there's, you know, not constitutional protections that are in play, whereas in firearms, there's definitely a Second Amendment that permits every American citizen. It does not authorize and allow terrorist members or members of a terrorist organization or group to go and, you know, purchase firearms. And I think what we're looking at is because, you know, not everybody that gets on that terror watch list is named Thomas. Some of them are named Dan Smith and, you know, Lord knows what else. We're quite the cultural mixture of people.
Well, let's fix
America.
The watch list. But are you suggesting that we don't have a constitutional right to travel?
Category.
Are you suggesting that there's no constitutional right to travel in the United States, that we live in, like, East Berlin? Like, you know, you need to get the permission of the police to go from your house to the store?
I'm not suggesting that there isn't any constitutional right to it, but what I am suggesting that when terms of matter and safety and concern, I think our legislatures have probably looked at it in terms of if we limit a couple of individuals' ability to travel based on some suspicions we have without a court procedure, I think that's a little bit different than when we say, hey, this thing which is emblazoned and embodied in the Second Amendment of every citizen.
That has the phrase well-regulated in it.
You know, I think there's a little level more scrutiny because, if you say I can't fly in the plane, well, you know what? What's to stop me from getting in my car? But if you say I can't own a firearm to protect myself, well, I guess I'd have to get a knife.
Not if you're a terrorist.
Some other method to
Neil, can you hear me?
Myself, which may not be as
he can't hear me
as needed or as much as I'd like.
Neil, when you're talking, if I try to talk, you can't hear me, right? It's not that you're ignoring me; it's that you genuinely can't hear me.
Probably. I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but it seems for some reason I don't know if it's the limiting software on the phone hybrid. We gotta do something about this. Anyway, my point was, if you have a problem with the terrorist watch list, let's fix the terrorist watch list. And if you think that there should be a judicial process, and frankly, I would agree with you on that, to before somebody gets put on the terrorist watch list and denied the right to travel, let's associate a judicial process with that. But that's an independent issue from whether somebody on a terrorist watch list should be allowed to walk into a gun show and walk out with 50 AK-47s.
Well,
why do you want terrorists to be able to buy, you know, literally, you know, a truckload of guns?
Well, you got to remember that this is, I would agree with you. There should be a judicial process with a terror watch list, but I don't even know what the standard or the level of scrutiny or what it takes to even be placed on the terror watch list. It may simply be a phone call from a concerned citizen, or it may be simply a phone call from an angry ex-spouse or an angry neighbor. Who knows what that level is?
I think if it was that simple, you'd have a whole lot of people being very, very PO'd at airports, and you would be hearing local news reports every single day about, you know, some guy who showed up who couldn't get on an airplane because his ex-wife or his girlfriend or, you know, or some woman whose, you know, stalker husband put her on the list or, you know, whatever. I mean, that would, if that was the case, if it was that easy, we would be hearing about these abuses left and right. And I mean, this is just common sense.
Well, how many firearms have been purchased from gun stores, and how many firearms?
Well,
have
we know according to
that Mr.
we know
John
according
the terrorists have obtained
Neil. We know that according to the Government Accountability Office, suspected terrorists, these are people who are not only on the terror watch list, but also the FBI thinks actually are terrorists, purchased firearms or explosives from licensed dealers 1,300 times over the course of the last 8.5 years.
And I understand, because our federal government, you know, gives them to the drug cartels down in Mexico. You know,
no, that's
sure
not the case. Those. If you're talking about the program that started under the Bush administration, that under Obama became what was it? What's it called? Fast and Furious. Yeah. If you're talking about that, that's a program that was the result of the state of Arizona passing a law that said that if you buy a gun from a registered gun dealer, it has to be for your own use. But you can change your mind as soon as you walk out of the store. And so the drug dealers hire what are called straw purchasers. They go into the stores, they buy 40, 50 guns, they walk out of the store, they say, gee, I guess I'm not going to use them anymore, and they sell them to the drug dealers, who then drive them down to Mexico. And because Jan Brewer and the Republicans in Arizona made it illegal for the government to stop that from happening, what the Obama and the Bush administrations were trying to do was at least keep track of them, follow them, because they had no legal ability to stop it, because Arizona had passed this, the Republicans in Arizona had passed this law saying, no, sorry, you have to sell these guns to straw purchasers. And, you know, ending straw purchasers was something that the Republicans filibustered a week or two ago as well. But that's a whole other thing also. This whole thing just blows my mind. You want to give terrorists guns, but you don't want to give them lawyers. You want to give them guns, but you don't want them to fly on airplanes.
Not at all.
I don't get it.
Guns. But I don't want to deny law-abiding American citizens their right to exercise their Second Amendment and claim, hey, we're trying to stop terrorists from getting guns. There's much better ways to handle them. As far as straw purchases go, I mean, that's illegal, whether it's done in Arizona, Florida.
It is not illegal in Arizona, and that's why Fast and Furious was down there, because you can change your mind under Arizona law in a second. In 1 second, you can change your mind about personal use. It is not illegal. Noel Flasterstein.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
GunRightsForYou.com is Noel's website. Noel, thanks for being with us.
And, of course, the White House press corps is here. I know CNN has taken some knocks lately, but the fact is I admire their commitment to cover all sides of the story, just in case one of them happens to be accurate.
That from from this weekend's White House Correspondents' Dinner. Last year I was there, and the year before last I was there, as I recall. But this year I was in Portland giving a speech on corporate personhood, which was great fun, and had a fine time doing that. But Barack Obama has some – he's either a good comedian or he's got some good comedic writers. Jeff in Coshocton, Ohio. Am I saying that right, Jeff?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You wanted to disagree about the gun show loophole? Why should we keep this loophole?
Yes, sir.
About half of all the guns sold in America are sold this way.
It's not been my experience that I can go to a gun show and buy a gun without a background check. Any gun show I've ever been to, I go into the gun show, want to buy a gun. They do a background check just like if I go to a gun dealer to buy a gun.
Well, that would be then you're going to a gun show where the dealers are licensed dealers and they just happen to be dealing in a gun show environment. And there are, you know, gun shows like that where licensed dealers get together and do them. But there are also gun shows that are not put on by licensed dealers and don't involve licensed dealers, and there is no background check necessary. It's the dealer, the licensed dealers, who have to do the background checks. And so at the gun shows, you know, it might not be licensed dealers who are selling. Make sense?
No, I don't agree.
Okay, not
any advertised gun show.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Jeff, thanks for the call. Jerry, in that case, then, you know, if that's the case, then why not, you know, why would all the Republicans say, no, we're gonna keep the gun show loophole? I mean, if there is no need for it, if, you know, everybody at the gun shows is already asking for background checks, then why did all these Republicans, except for John McCain, basically say, we'd like to keep that loophole, it's just fine, let terrorists buy guns? Jerry in Hartville, Missouri. Hey, Jerry, you want to talk about the Second Amendment?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
On the Second Amendment,
right,
the forefathers, because Jefferson and many others were fearful of government, and even though the framers at the convention had, from what I understand, given assurances that there was no power to violate the liberty, then the Bill of Rights was added anyway, and it's more or less an adjunct or a backup to the security of liberty. And on the Second Amendment, a lot of them seem to focus just on what's there, but if you go to the Ninth Amendment, well, then you have all of those other rights that are included, and that would include the right to wear your gun and buy your bullets and a whole host of things not stated in the amendment.
How about the right to be free of people who wear guns and carry bullets?
Well, then think of a situation where this is an unsafe world. There have been times way back to Middle East when people just had swords. So if you were living in some hut in the desert and a bunch of people came by with swords, you'd need a sword to defend yourself or something.
Yeah, Jerry, I'm just not that frightened. You know, and the fact of the matter is you have your history wrong. The founders, go back and read the Constitutional Convention, the debates during the Constitutional Conventions. In particular, read the speeches given by George Mason and James Madison during the Virginia Constitutional Ratifying Convention. You can find them online. These guys never even imagined. There was never any discussion about Americans being armed so that Americans could kill American politicians or take out an oppressive American government. It was never even discussed. These guys had fought, and many of them had died, to create the American government. The idea was twofold. In the North, principally, the concern was that a standing army during time of peace had standing armies during times of peace, it's called military juntas or military overthrows or military coups, had repeatedly in nations throughout the history of Europe overthrown democratic governments or even semi-democratic governments, in many cases had overthrown kings. And so they figured that during times of peace there should not be a standing army. There should be a citizens' militia that was answerable to a non-military authority, to a civilian authority, And they wanted to limit that to the governors of the states. And so you had basically what we call the National Guard, the state militias. And that's why the Second Amendment says the security of a free state, not the security of a free nation. In the South, the constitutions of Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina required every male between the ages of 17 and 47 to be members of the slave patrols, which were also the state militias. And they had to, it varied from month to month, but there's a book called Slave Patrols by a woman named Sally. I'm forgetting her last name right now, but she documents this whole thing in just excruciating detail over about 250 pages with all these quotes from all these stories. And in the South, the slave patrols were the state militias, and they had, and you had to show up for the slave patrol once every 3 or 4 weeks for a day or so. You had to give it a day of your time. And the slave patrols traveled around looking for African Americans who were not on the plantations, and they would threaten them and beat them or kill them, and they had to be armed. But the fact of the matter is that very few people had arms back in the late 1700s and early 1800s, because it cost so much. You could, the cost of a high quality gun back then was not that different than about the cost of a house. I mean, it was really expensive. During the election of 1800, when Jefferson was elected, it was estimated that about 12% of Americans had guns. People didn't hunt, by and large. They were professional hunters. And, they sold their meat to butchers. And then, of course, you had farmers. And so people, ate just like we do. They ate cows and sheep and things. So, the militias, in many cases, in most cases, particularly in the North, but also in the South, there were armories. The cities would maintain armories where the militias would keep the weapons, mainly because they rusted so easily and they had to be maintained. So there would be somebody whose job it was to just every day go through and clean and oil these things, because this was all before stainless steel. Jerry, check your history.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. I don't understand. I mean, Wayne Littlepierre even said before Congress that these are to protect us against the government. What? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I find this absolutely bizarre. Igor Volsky reporting over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, that this Senator Jim Inhofe, the Republican from Oklahoma, that Jim Inhofe says, the terrorists, they're part of it, not by definition part of a criminal, but because they're terrorists, but I would say the same thing is true for terrorists as for criminals. And that is, if someone in the United States of America or any other place too, the criminal element, the terrorist element, they're going to be able to get one of these. He's talking about guns. The problem I have is that any restriction, such as the one we voted against last week, would have the effect of reducing the number of firearms nationwide and would disproportionately reduce them for law-abiding citizens. That's what I would say to Joe Scarborough. Right. So by telling people who are on the terrorist watch list that they can't get on an airplane, but they can buy a gun, we are somehow reducing the number of guns in the hands of law-abiding people. What am I missing here? Is this crazy? Anyhow, Dave, Louise yells yes. David in Pacific Washington, listening on KBCS, you have the information on the 40-hour work week. Hey, Dave.
Well, my reference is from the Cowles Volume Library,
mm-hmm.
And it states that in 1869, there was a passage of the 8-hour law for federal employees.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which was, the beginning of our, what we call modern workaday.
Right. Right.
And I certainly believe that it's time to adjust that to at least give people benefits if they've indebted themselves to a company for 25 years. Give them 25 hours a
right.
week or a week for a
Okay, but here's the looking in the chat room here, Sue Nethercutt posted this. The 8-hour day may have been realized for many working people. Now, that might have been federal employees and, post-Lincoln, but in 1937, it was called the Fair Labor Standards Act, 29 U.S. Code Chapter 8, was the first one of the first proposals was first proposed under the New Deal. That was the 8-hour day for everybody in addition to federal employees. But that's interesting. The federal employees all the way back in 18, did you say 50 or 69?
1869.
Fascinating. David, thanks for the information. Thanks for the call. Jeff, listening on AM 760 in Longmont, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Good day, Tom.
Hey, Jeff.
So,
gun loopholes.
You know, full disclosure, I'm a gun owner and I hunt.
Okay.
And we just passed some laws here in Colorado.
Right.
And one of the laws that we passed was the law that you couldn't, as a private citizen, go into a gun show and sell a gun without a background check.
Right.
Without a background check. And what some of the gun shop owners were doing was going into the shows as private citizens and selling guns that they couldn't sell in their shop.
Or they would hire somebody to do it for them, presumably.
Yeah. And so you could go in and buy a gun because, you know, I could go in and sell my gun as a private citizen without anyone having a background check.
Right, right. In other words, you could sell a gun to a terrorist.
Or
a wife beater, or somebody who's been adjudicated mentally ill and violent,
whatever.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I don't know where these people, you know, I mean, every state's different, and that is.
Yeah, but you guys in Colorado closed the gun show loophole, you're saying, and it doesn't sound like the sky has fallen in, or Colorado has turned into a tyranny.
There's none of that going on.
Yeah, okay.
If I go out and hunt ducks, I can only have 3 shotgun shells.
Yeah, yeah, the old duck plug thing, yep.
And if I have more than that, then I'm breaking the law and they can take my gun.
Yeah. Well, I thought they could fine you. I didn't know that they could take your gun.
Well, they can fine me, but they can take your gun too.
Huh.
And that's, you know, I can't have more than 3 shells in there. I have to have a plug in it.
Yeah.
If I don't have the plug in there, that's like I have more shells in there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's silly.
And that's common all across the United States. You know, it's just these are rules, by the way, that were proposed generally by sportsmen. You know, by sports shooters.
Yeah, we passed a 15-round clip, and I don't think that goes far enough.
Yeah.
You know, in all of my life hunting deer, I've shot twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I've shot twice.
Yeah, it's.
You know, if you're shooting 5 times, people are like, "What is your problem?"
Yeah, exactly. And if you need a 30-round clip to take down a doe, you shouldn't be out in the woods with a gun. I mean, you just seriously shouldn't be out in the woods with a gun. And the rest of us don't want to be out there with you, but with that person. But, Jeff, thank you for being a responsible gun owner, and thank you for sharing your story with us. And thanks for listening to AM 760 there in Denver. Matt in Amherst, Massachusetts, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite network. Hey, Matt,
hey,
what's
how
up?
How you doing? Not too much. I have a couple comments. I think one of the biggest problems with this whole with this gun show thing is that it shouldn't be it mostly is state regulated instead of federally regulated because as I've seen I've gone to nearly every gun show. I'm going to have a list of them up here from around New England, and I'm from Vermont really, which has very very loose laws.
Yeah.
But still, even in Vermont, we don't have any places where you can just go into a gun show and buy it. Straight from someone without a background check. Every time I've bought one, which I've bought in a couple of rifles in the recent months, they've all been background checks. You know, and I'm a younger person. I'm 26 years old, so you know, I'd assume that they'd give me a background check regardless. Especially my short history of owning guns. So I think it's more of a state to state thing, and especially see the problem rampant on the border, like Texas and Arizona.
Yeah, yeah. It is a state to state thing, and the biggest problems with these unregulated gun shows and the sales thereof are in those southern border states, and it's because there's so much money to be made. The gun manufacturers are making an absolute fortune, and they're selling them, and they're being sold in these gun shows either directly to people who are then taking them down to Mexico for use in drug wars, or to straw purchasers who are you know, buying them for their own use and then walking out the door and deciding and changing their mind, as Arizona law allows you to do within, you know, 1 minute or 30 seconds or something
exactly.
like that.
Well, why is the push not for these states to change and not for the entire nation to change, whereas most of the nation already abides by those rules? Now, I support some type of gun regulation. I don't think anyone off the street should just buy any gun. For an example, my license actually got left by a gun dealer at the last, at one of the last shows I went to, and I was really absolutely pissed because, you know, in Vermont, you can probably take my license if you look like me and buy a gun. So I fully support, you know, some terms of regulation, but to the extreme that, you know, the federal government wants to get involved is a little ridiculous. And I think more scrutiny should be put on the state.
Well, I think the problem, Matt, is in those states, you've got legislators, the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, put together by the Koch brothers and others, that basically runs the Republican side of state legislatures and proposes legislation for them and gets them together twice a year, 50-50 legislators and corporate lobbyists to write laws that to the benefit of the lobbyists. And that, you know, these legislatures are in particularly in these states that are largely Republican dominated are owned by the weapons industry. It's a very profitable multi-billion dollar industry, and they've got a lot of money to buy legislators. And those legislators are not going to close the gun show loopholes in their states. And so this was an attempt to simply do it federally, you know, to do it nationwide, which it just seems to be like common sense. You know, it's like if you can't get on an airplane, you shouldn't be able to buy an AR-15. It just makes sense. Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Tom in Bay City, Texas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking the call. I'm wanting to thank the Republicans for their vote the other day. I'm a disabled veteran, mm-hmm. and since they want to cut that as well as Social Security, which I depend on both, mm-hmm. I'm thanking them for providing us an opportunity so that we can manufacture suspenders, because according to NRA logic, not only would we have to carry our Glocks, but we would also now, because of the Boston fiasco, we'd have to carry hand grenades. Because, you know, the only good guy is one with the bomb throw at a bomber.
Right. The only good guy who's going to stop a bomber is the only way to stop a bad guy with a bomb is for a good guy to have a bomb. So we should all carry hand grenades.
Isn't that what they said?
Well, you know, in a way it was. I mean, the NRA is the lobbyist for the bombers back in the 1960s. When the bombings were being done by liberals or leftists, right, the Weather Underground, and they killed a couple people and they blew up a whole bunch of buildings. And, you know, back in the 60s and 70s when that was going on, there was an effort to put what are called chemical taggants. These are, you know, just little tiny trace amounts of a chemical in black powder and smokeless powder and gunpowder that would allow you to track a bullet or an explosive. In the case of these Weather Underground bombs, the explosive itself, back to where it was sold, back to its manufacturer and you know, the chain of custody. And the NRA argued against that. That was proposed again in the 1980s after Reagan was shot. The NRA shot that down, pun intended, I guess. And it was proposed again a couple of years ago, and the NRA blocked that. So the NRA is very much, you know, Wayne Little Pierre is the...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
He's the lobbyist for the bombers as well as for the gun guys, the shooters. That's strange. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, and Jack in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, Jack, background checks won't stop criminals?
I don't think so, and the reason why I say this is that if you went to background checks,
right?
Okay, if a person really wants to buy a gun, he'll buy it off the street.
Well, if a person really wants to rob a bank, they're going to rob a bank. Does that mean that we should do away with laws against robbing banks?
No, I didn't. You're talking about two different things now.
Okay, if somebody wants to have a car and they don't have the money to pay for it, they'll figure out a way to get that car.
Okay, what I'm saying is this. The law that they're trying to pass is for a background check.
Right.
Symbolic.
Right.
Basically because I know something happened and you want to do something, right?
Well, no, it's because right now people who are mentally ill, people in ways that are associated with violence, people who have been adjudicated violently mentally ill, people who are, who have restraining orders against them, and people who are known terrorists can walk into a gun store and buy all the guns they want. And there's something wrong with that. I agree with you. No law is going to be 100% effective, but that's not a reason not to have the law.
Okay, but you don't have a database for that right now. You still got HIPAA laws and other laws to prevent people from the government from doing that.
I'm talking about adjudicated violently mentally ill. In other words, they've gone through the court system because of their mental illness, they have assaulted somebody, and typically this is domestic violence, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's, you know, people who've, like, just, you know, gotten in so many barroom fights or whatever. And anybody who has been through the legal system and has been convicted of a violent crime, in my opinion, should not be able to buy a gun.
Okay.
What's wrong with that?
Well, there's a problem with that. Say, for example, these same people who have been convicted of the crime are in done their time and have their civil rights given back to them, going through the motion. Mm. Somebody break into their house, and they're vulnerable. I mean, they're vulnerable, and they should have the right to be able to protect themselves.
You know, people who stop burglars with guns breaking into their houses, the number of times that happens successfully in the United States is the tiniest sliver of a fraction compared to the number of times that people shoot themselves by accident, that or their kids kill other kids by accident, or that people commit suicide with guns. I mean, that's happening about 80, 85 times a day. And you may be, stopping a home invasion, I don't know, a couple times a week nationwide or something like that, But we can have a conversation about whether, you know, if somebody is rehabilitated, should they have their rights back? Should they have their vote back? Should they have the right to buy a gun? And I think that, reasonable people can differ on that, and it's probably best left up to a judge rather than having some sort of a blanket statement with regard to that. Because I do believe in redemption. I do believe in rehabilitation.
Two things figure this.
But still, why allow terrorists, people on the terror watch list, to buy guns?
Okay, then first of all, do you know where this particular terrorist got his gun from? Did he get it off the street, or did he walk into a store and get it? Have that been established yet?
Well, we know that according to the Government Accountability Office, which just, keeps track of this kind of, at the request of Congress, keeps track of this kind of stuff, that licensed gun dealers sold explosives and firearms to suspected terrorists 1,300 times since 2004.
Okay.
Because there's no law that prevents them from doing it.
Okay. What I'm saying is, this terrorist who's up there in Boston area.
Right.
Where did he buy his gun from? Did he buy it from a gun dealer?
Oh, it wasn't a gun. It was fireworks that he used to get the black powder. And he bought it under his own name, and he bought it from a fireworks shop, either in Northern Mass or Southern New Hampshire, as I recall. And had the NRA not forbidden the government from requiring explosives, like including fireworks, to have these taggant chemicals, basically little chemicals in there that allow you to identify where it came from. If there had been a taggant in those pressure cooker bombs, in the black powder that he had used, he'd opened up a whole bunch of fireworks and used that to make those bombs. Had there been a taggant in that stuff, they would have known the store that sold it the day of the explosion. And had they gone to that store, I mean, the owner of the store came out and said, hey, here's the receipt. The guy bought it in his own name. But it was like 4 days later. Had the NRA not lobbied against these taggants, we would have known within an hour of the time that explosion happened who bought that black powder. And since he did buy it in his own name, we would have known who the killer was. So, again, Wayne Little Pierre or Wayne Lop. Peter or whatever is he lobbyist for bomb makers. It makes me crazy. Denny in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Denny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for coming to Salem Saturday.
Oh, that was a hoot. I had a great time.
Yeah. My sister and I were heading to the coast a couple years ago, and there's a gun show in Dallas, Oregon, which if you do a history check on Dallas, you'll find out that it had at one time in the 30s the largest population, the Ku Klux Klan, this side of the Mississippi. So we were talking. I go, you know, I bet you I can go in there and buy a gun and be out in 5 minutes. And I did. I bought a .357 single action. Oh, it was an old pistol. And the only thing the guy asked me was, are you a cop?
Huh.
And I did it just to prove a point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a pretty expensive way to prove a point. A .357 revolver, what did it cost you? $300-$400?
No, it was only $150 and I paid cash.
Wow.
And I later took it down to the state police and I said, will you do a check on this? And I told them what I did, you know, and they looked at me funny, and 2 days later they came back and it's clean. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you got a clean gun anyway. Denny, you know, let me encourage you to do some sports shooting with it. The 357 has a hell of a kick, but that means you've got to be that much better as a target shooter. It is 2 minutes before the top of the hour. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tip of the hat to Jason Collins, by the way, the first openly gay NBA active player. Good on Jason Collins. He says he's 34. He's a free agent now. And he said, he's playing for the Washington Wizards, although their season has ended, so he felt like he could come out, you know, after the season was over. He says, I wish I wasn't the kid in the classroom raising his hand and saying I'm different. This was posted on Sports Illustrated Online. He said, if I had my way, someone else would have already done this. Nobody has, which is why I'm raising my hand. Here's my chance to be heard. And he was talking about the pain he experienced when the Supreme Court arguments about gay marriage were happening. And he said, here was my chance to be heard, and I couldn't say a thing. I didn't want to answer questions and draw attention to myself, not while I was playing. But he decided to go public. This is from a piece by Arturo Garcia over at Raw Story. I decided to go public after the 2012 Gay Rights Parade. His former college roommate, Congressman Joe Kennedy, who's straight, marched in the parade. And he was afraid to march with him in support of his gay brothers and sisters because he didn't want people to think that he was gay because he thought it would, whatever, hurt his career or what. So he says, I was proud of him, Joe Kennedy, for participating, but angry that as a closeted gay man, I couldn't even cheer my straight friend on as a spectator, said Collins, who played for the Boston Celtics at that time. He said, if I'd been questioned, I would have concocted half-truths. What a shame to have to live a lie at a celebration of pride. I want to do the right thing and not hide anymore. I want to march for tolerance, acceptance, and understanding. I want to take a stand and say, me too. And then when responding to a comment by, who was it? I'm missing it here. L.A. Lakers coach Phil Jackson. He said, never seen a gay person ever. Nope. Never happened. And so Collins responded to this. He's played for six teams during his career. And he says, some people insist they've never met a gay person, but 3 degrees of Jason Collins dictates that no NBA player can claim that anymore because pro basketball is a family, and pretty much every family I know has a brother, sister, or cousin who's gay. And in the brotherhood of the NBA, I just happen to be the one who's out. And, you know, good on him. In addition, Sandra Day O'Connor, the fifth vote for Bush v. Gore, which made George W. Bush our president, because Al Gore actually got more votes in Florida than Bush did. Al Gore actually won the election, and he got 500,000 more votes nationwide. Saturday O'Connor is now saying publicly, damn, wish we hadn't done that. Words to that effect. I find that pretty amazing. Kelly Ayotte, the Republican from New Hampshire who voted to allow terrorists, people on the terror watch list, to buy guns. The NRA is running ads in New Hampshire. It's a cheap media market. Saying, isn't she wonderful? She's voting to let terrorists buy guns. Isn't she? I mean, they didn't quite say it that way. Okay. And on top of that, you need to know this. Our leaders are killing us. Killing us with economic policies based on a failed ideology loved only by the elites who invented it. David Stuckler and Sanjay Basu have a new book out. It's called The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills. They're both professors. One's an economist at Oxford. The other's an epidemiologist at Stanford. And they make what some would say obvious, others would say startling, the claim that the long-term effects of cuts to social services and government programs, a.k.a. austerity, have destroyed the European economy and thrown millions of people into unemployment. And according to Stuckler and Basso's research, not only do these savage cuts stunt growth and prolong recessions, they are also a major public health problem. In Greece, the victim of some of the EU's harshest austerity policies, cuts to mosquito spraying programs resulted in that Balkan nation's first malaria epidemic since the 1970s. Decreased funding for HIV prevention programs, again, part of European austerity, have coincided with a 200% increase in infection rates in Europe in just the past 2 years. The devastating public health impact of budget cuts aren't just a European problem, by the way. Here in the United States, we call it sequestration. I was on an airplane yesterday. I was on two airplanes yesterday. I flew Portland, Chicago, Chicago here to D.C. And, you know, they slowed down the controllers. Every 14 days, I guess it is, every air traffic controller has to take one day off without pay. That's part of the sequestration, the austerity. And, boy, did that get some people's panties in a wad. I'm telling you, that really, really, I mean, you get rich white businessmen on airplanes, and women for that matter, but I'm guessing it was probably more the men who were driving this, and wealthy politicians, and their planes are late, and they're missing their connections. They make things happen. And so we have entered the age of austerity as well. And just like in Greece, those who need the public's help the most are suffering as a result, while the people, you know, the people who are flying around the country, the Republicans are going to do it. They're going to fix that. But as a result of completely avoidable across-the-board cuts to Medicare, cancer clinics across our country are telling patients they can't give them chemotherapy. Sorry. One of my daughters goes to school at, and another works in the emergency room at one of the largest hospitals in Georgia, or in Oregon. And they were telling me over the weekend, we had breakfast Sunday morning, and they were, or Saturday morning, they were telling me how the hospital is taking a, as I recall, it was $30 million, might be $60 million, but my recollection is it was a $30 million cut from the sequestration. And it's like, you know, so everybody's, you know, more and more people are having to do volunteer work, they're having to work longer hours, they're having to kick in hours, you know, without pay. This is bizarre. Oh, this is Republican America. Federal Meals and Wheels programs no longer able to deliver healthy meals to tens of thousands of seniors in need. The most recent number I heard is 70,000. Administrators at One Virginia Meals and Wheels Center say that this is the first cut that they've ever seen since the program was created in 72. Keep in mind, Meals on Wheels brings food to people who otherwise wouldn't have food. What makes all this suffering all the more tragic is that the ideas behind it are based on both a faulty economic theory and shoddy research done to try to back up that theory. 2 weeks ago, graduate students at the University of Massachusetts published a critique of the famous Reinhart-Rogoff study that has been used by everyone from Paul Ryan to Rand Paul to the Simpson Bowlers to justify full-throttle European-style austerity. According to the researchers, this Reinhart-Rogoff study, which concluded that high amounts of debt stunt economic growth when it goes over 90% of GDP, is full of distortions, exclusions, and outright lies. Reinhart and Rogoff excluded important evidence from their final analysis. And in one instance, there's an entire line of data on the spreadsheet that was supposed to auto-calculate that didn't. It wasn't even considered. But the tide is turning. Last month, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew called on his European counterparts to end their foolish budget cuts and instead focus on unemployment. And in Italy, last week said, okay, we're going to do that. We're going to end the austerity nonsense. And this week, they had a bond sale. And guess what? The cost, the interest rate that they had to pay for their bonds actually went down, which means people have, you know, people have, again, confidence in Italy. So they could borrow at the lowest rate since 2010. I mean, it should be as obvious to Washington as it is to the rest of the world. Austerity is a complete and total failure. I mean, Congress, I mean, the proof of this, look at they're rehiring air traffic controllers. How about everybody else?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, we have a little clip from Steny Hoyer I will share with you after the break about that. He had some very to-the-point comments. Stick around. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's 21 minutes past the hour. And, Kendall has a unique suggestion in Bridgewater, South Dakota. Listening on Sirius. Hey, Kendall, you have a solution to the terror watch list?
Yeah, why don't you just put all us NRA members on the terror watch list and maybe some Christian groups, and that would pretty much fix everything, wouldn't it?
You know, the NRA started as a sportsman's organization. They used to, I'm assuming they still do, offer a very, very good gun safety program, gun use and gun safety program. I went through it back a decade or more ago. The NRA used to be a good organization, and then they basically got taken over by the gun manufacturers, which is where they get most of their money. And so now Wayne LaPeter, makes $2 million a year to be the spokesperson for them. And, I don't think NRA members are terrorists. In fact, the majority of NRA members wanted they wanted to close the gun show loophole. They wanted, you know, anybody who buys a gun to have to, you know, go through this 2-minute background check to make sure that they're not on the terrorist watch list or they haven't been adjudicated of a violent crime or a violent mental illness. And it just makes
sense. I don't
know
where you got your polling from on that, but that's absolutely not true.
Okay. What's true then?
Yeah, I've seen other polls done by the NRA themselves polling their own members, and it was like 90% don't want anything to do with any more gun control laws.
Yeah, well, with any more gun control laws, but this wasn't a gun control law. This did not control guns. This controlled the ability of terrorists to buy guns, number one. And number two...
How is that supposed to happen? You know, your tagging thing you were talking about... That just made reloading unsafe because the tags
were
little plastic chips with numbers on them.
No, it didn't.
The
tags were not little plastic chips with numbers on them. They were microscopic. Back in the day, they might have been. Now they can do it just with a particular chemical signature. But, the NRA, yes, put out, publicity to the effect back in the 60s and 70s and 80s that the tagants would make it harder to load your own, your own bullets and things like that. It's not true. It's simply not true. It's been debunked. It's been totally debunked. It's just not true. And the polling does show that the majority of NRA members are in favor of background checks. Gun control, but they're in favor of background checks. Kendall, I beg your pardon? The Quinnipiac poll, which is not a, this is not a political organization. Edward in McRae, Arkansas. Hey, Edward, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite TV Network. What's up?
May I call you Tom?
You certainly may.
Okay.
That's my name.
First of all, I love you, respect you, you're a hero. It's McRae, Arkansas. I was telling your girl that in 97, there was a violent death by a mentally ill man named Matthew Brower. And what had happened, this is in Phoenix, Arizona.
Hmm.
And what has happened is Matthew's mother, Marilyn, since this boy was a child, she knew he had big problems. He would draw pictures of her, and of him killing her and her blood, and he threatened her, and he's typical loved mother by his mother. And what had ended up happening was he was in a mental institution for years, and they actually called his mother and said, "Look, we don't have any more space for him." Now, real quick, before that, he actually had two episodes, one where he cut off part of his penis and laid it on a counter at a Smitty store in
Whoa.
Phoenix, and one where he actually went, what happened was after he got out, his mother said, "Please, please, no, don't let him free." And they said, "Well, we're going to put him on the street. We'd really appreciate it if you put him up and not keep him on the street, and we'll keep him medicated." So she says, well, she didn't want to, but she took him back in. Within less than 2 weeks, he went to a Kmart, bought a shotgun, went over, and his mother was laying on the couch and blew her head off.
Wow.
And, a year later, I was running for state senator in Mesa, Arizona, as a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And her Maryland sister flew in, who's a Democrat, from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And tried to get me to support this, and I tried to get a law passed as part of my platform called Maryland's Law. I think there needs to be some kind of, everybody's paranoid. I'm even a little bit, I'm a little skeptical of our government. But there is a middle road. If you said to people, you know what? What if we just keep the background checks like we have now? But we have a list where we actually put people that have been adjudicated as mentally ill. That is severely and
violently mentally ill. If somebody just has attention deficit disorder or something, I don't have. I have ADD. I've never been adjudicated or formally diagnosed, but I'll self-diagnose. I think I ought to be able to buy a gun. But if somebody has threatened others, or if they've beaten others, or if they've shot at other people, or if they've been like the young man that you were talking about, adjudicated mentally ill, in a way that's associated with violence, that's a person that I don't think should be allowed to buy a gun or own a gun.
Well, exactly. That's the case. This guy was in an institution for years.
Yeah.
And but you know what the middle road is?
What's that?
One step at a time. For example, what if you said to the NRA and all their supporters and all of the hardcore people that, that way, okay, well, all we want to do is maybe at least take a middle step where there's a list and these people go on that list along with the terrorists. And anybody that sells, from private individuals, there have to be something from one to another. But if you just had to listen, and there wasn't a full background check, so that folks like my neighbors out here in McRae, Arkansas, now they don't want the government to know they have a damn gun.
Yeah. Well, running a background check and keeping a gun registry are two completely separate things. And in fact, this legislation actually put into law a law forbidding the government from creating a gun registry. So you'd think that the NRA would have loved it. Edward, thanks for the call. But no, it had to do with guns. They were poached.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's really quite remarkable. NRA, lobbyist for bombers and mass murderers. 28 minutes past the hour. The bad and the very, very foodroyantly ugly. The good. Jason Collins. In an exclusive cover story for the most recent issue of Sports Illustrated, NBA center Jason Collins made a surprising announcement. Quote, "I'm a 34-year-old NBA center. I'm black and I'm gay. I didn't set out to be the first openly gay athlete playing in a major American team sport, but since I am, I'm happy to start the conversation. I wish I wasn't the kid in the classroom raising his hand and saying I'm different. If I had my way, someone else would have already done this. Nobody has, which is why I'm raising my hand." End quote. Collins' announcement comes at an important moment for professional sports. Although a handful of retired athletes have gone public with their sexuality, no active player in any of the major leagues has come out of
come out, and locker room homophobia remains a major problem. But the tide is turning. Just last month, the NHL began a joint partnership with the You Can Play Group, an organization devoted to fighting anti-gay bigotry in sports. At such a time, Collins' announcement could be a major catalyst for change in the American athletic culture. Good work, Jason. The bad. The Tennessee Firearms Association. The volunteer state-based gun group recently sponsored a lottery giveaway of an AR-15 assault rifle. While raffling away the same weapon used by Adam Lanza in the Newtown shootings is questionable enough, the group's advertisement for the promotion makes the whole situation all the more concerning. According to the TFA's website, it is, quote, giving away a Bushmaster AR-15 to advance the effort to resist Barack Obama, the federal government, and even a few in Tennessee state government who are determined to destroy your Second Amendment rights, end quote. Great. Because what we really need at this time of heightened right-wing militia activity is more fear-mongering from pro-gun groups. This kind of rhetoric is tone-deaf at best and downright dangerous at worst. And the very, very ugly, who else but Congressman Louis Gohmert. During a recent appearance on WND Radio, the Texas congressman had some, well, interesting things to say about the Obama administration and its handling of terrorism.
Because radical Islam is at war with us. Thank God for the moderates that don't approve of what's being done. But this administration has so many Muslim Brotherhood members that have influence that they just are making wrong decisions for America.
Remember, people, the man you just heard hawking bigoted conspiracy theories isn't some random crazy guy on the street. He's an elected member of our House of Representatives. And that is very, very ugly. That's incredible. That's just incredible. Jerry in Amityville, New York, listening to WWRL in New York City. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, maybe we should have mental health tests and background checks on politicians before they go into politics.
Well, but we sort of do. They're called elections. And you know, generally, I mean, you know, you look at what's happening to Mark Sanford right now. You know, the people are figuring him out.
Yeah. Well, as you were discussing, a little about the gun issue, and as you were discussing in the first hour with your first guest, I find it ironic and hypocritical that some of these very same right-wing individuals who seem to have such a love regard and such little concern for people's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights and who want to seem to do away these days with the Miranda warning. But then these same right-wingers, they seem to want to turn around and lionize and treat as both absolute and almost sacred the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution to the point of placing our national security in jeopardy, in my opinion, right, by allowing not only people on terrorist watch lists to them, to be able to buy virtually any firearm they want. But also in addition, we recently had two actual accused terrorists, the Boston bombers, who, let's not forget, they did get in use against the police a whole bunch of firearms.
Right. Although we don't, to the best of my knowledge, we don't know yet where they got them or how they got them. But, yeah, they killed a police officer. I mean, they shot and killed a police officer. They had a couple of shootouts at the police. And it's going to be interesting to find out where those guns came from. Jerry, thank you very much. And I'm surprised that the news media hasn't been digging on that one more and more. Mother Jones has? Okay, we'll track it down. Nick in Las Vegas, Nevada, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite network. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to give my take on the gun control debate in this country. You basically, in a nutshell, you cannot trust the United States government when it comes to regulating the use of firearms, when it comes to the debate on firearms, when there's no discussion in this country on mainstream media, hardly at all, with Department of Homeland Security buying up over 2 billion rounds of ammunition. They've got 2,700 light armored tank vehicles in their possession, but yet they want to disarm the citizens.
The ammunition that the government buys every year has pretty much not changed over the years. I mean, it's gotten somewhat larger since 2011, but most of that is used for target practice. You have to train police officers every couple months. They have to recertify. They have to be on the range every week, or every, you know, it depends on the type of officer and what they're doing. But, you know, this whole Alex Jones, oh, my God, the government's stockpiling bullets and you know, the these kinds of weapons is Nick, you know, relax. Our government is not out to get us. Our government is us. That's the United States of America. We are our government. And if you don't like the way it's going, run for political office. Or join a political party and get involved and help write the political platforms and just help decide who's going to be the primary candidates. Jim in Hillsboro, Oregon, watching on freespeechtv.org. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Hey, I wanted to talk a little bit about austerity. But first of all, hey, I met you the other night here in Portland. I was so grateful to see you. That was great.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being there. It was a lot of fun being there. So what's
up? Austerity. You know, I spelled it out the other day, and, you know, it really is a four-letter word. I think so. And I've got two things. One is a quick story. I'm a software consultant, and I work my main client is in education.
Mm-hmm.
And in a business meeting here a couple of weeks ago, they were looking at the, you know, the future, and it looks like education is really reluctant to make purchases, you know, to make commitments, because of uncertainty. Not so much that they don't have the budget, but there is uncertainty.
Yeah.
And that can be a killer. And I piped up and I said, do you remember a few years ago when austerity was not yet in the vocabulary and we were talking about the stimulus?
Right.
It was a whole different environment.
Right, right. You're talking about in the field of education.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Jim, thanks for sharing that with us, and great to see you in Oregon yesterday or the day before. Thanks for calling. Thanks for watching on Free Speech TV. Mike, listening on WCPT in Chicago, in Palatine, Illinois.
Hey, Tom. Hey, how are you? Before I get to my point, I just wanted to do. I wanted to tell you about, you know, everyone has a certain famous speech I would have loved witnessing, whether it's Martin Luther King or John F. Kennedy. The library, the George W. Bush Library, Mike Malloy walking up to the podium.
Hey!
I would have loved to see that.
I would have paid to see that, definitely.
Right. Why is it easier for someone to get a library than it is to get to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? But that's besides the point.
Yeah. Well, you know, you get a bunch of donors who cough up a couple million bucks and poof, you got yourself something that's called a library that's actually a whitewash PR attempt, you know, but in any case.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the reason I was calling was I used to go to gun shows. I went for about 20 years, and let me tell you how the selling of guns goes on illegally at all gun shows, at least in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Is what happens is, say, for example, I have a friend named Pat who goes to these gun shows and he has a table set up. Well, I'll go see Pat and Pat will tell me, well, you see John over there? Just tell him you're a friend of mine and you want to go have dinner with him tonight. So he'll walk up to a table or someone will walk up to a table and say, that's a really nice Desert Eagle that you have right there. Would you be interested in going out for dinner this evening? Sure, let's meet at this steakhouse. Right away, the owner of the gun knows that this guy either doesn't have a FOID card or can't pass a background check. He already told him what gun he was interested in, so he knows to bring that gun to the dinner with him. And that's
right.
How they sell them.
You
know, and then
okay.
What else they do is everyone is like a big, tight-knit family at these shows. You'll have like 200-300 tables set up. Inevitably, someone will know someone from the ATF. And the minute someone spots an ATF agent, they'll instantly start tailing them. And the minute the ATF agent walks up to a table, the person behind him will say, don't sell to him. He's with ATF.
Huh.
And that's how they do it. Everyone watches each other's bases at these shows.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so for them to say that this doesn't go on, I experienced it. I witnessed it for 20 years. So
yeah.
It's, you know, I don't know, maybe.
Well, I mean, the NRA and Wayne LaPeter is, or Little Peter, LaPierre, is promoting a very bizarre schizophrenic message, which is on the one hand, there's no, you know, gun shows. We don't use the, you know, terrorists can't go to gun shows, and crazy people who have been committed for, you know, violent crimes can't. They're not buying things at gun shows. There's no, you know, don't pull back that curtain. There's nobody there. Oh, and by the way, and so we don't need the law, and we don't need the law. I mean, you know, it's not happening, but passing the law would be a terrible thing. So something's not happening, and you pass a law against it, what does it matter? You would think, you know, if it wasn't happening, the NRA should be saying, sure, go ahead, you know, pass the checks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, in 15 minutes, Jeremy Scahill is going to join us for our Conversations with Great Minds. He's going to be with us for an hour talking about his new book and movie project. It's amazing. Stick around. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of your goat and the person you helped. Victoria, what's going on today?
Well, hi, Tom. The U.S. Supreme Court today turned aside an appeal from the state of Alabama asking the high court to examine whether state governments can pass laws making it illegal to harbor or smuggle illegal immigrants within a state borders. Now, it came without comment from the justices, but they did note that Justice Antonin Scalia dissented from the court's decision not to hear the case. He wanted to take it. Now, the question in the Alabama case is whether Alabama's anti-harboring statute is preempted by federal immigration laws. And the portion of the Alabama law that was being appealed involved state prohibitions on harboring, inducing the arrival, or transporting illegal immigrants in Alabama. And so the other states may be impacted by this: Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Kansas, Michigan, Oklahoma, and South Carolina, all wanting to have similar things in their state's laws. These are all modeled after Arizona.
Very interesting. Do you know if this came out of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council?
I don't know. I have to say I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Yeah, typically when you see the same language being introduced by Republican legislators in, you know, dozens of states, it's an ALEC bill. What else is up?
The cash for Karzai story that appeared in the New York Times today,
yes,
in which it turns out the CIA for many years now, about the last 10 years, every month has been dropping off in suitcases, backpacks, and sometimes plastic shopping bags, wads of cash every month to Hamid Karzai's office in the presidential palace, adding up to tens of millions of dollars,
right,
which is going to pay off warlords and corrupt politicians, and is ending up subverting our exit strategy to the consternation of the FBI and the people who are trying to get us out, who are ticked off with the CIA, who are saying, you're doing exactly the opposite of what we want to do, and we're ending up with a criminal enterprise here. Well, Hamid Karzai today at a press conference in Finland said, yeah, the CIA has been doing this, and thank you very much. It was a small amount, and it's been used for various purposes.
Wow.
So,
do you think it's going to stop now?
Well, I don't know whether it's going to stop. I actually suspect not.
Yeah, I suspect not, too, at least until all of our troops are out of the country. Then,
well,
maybe.
What's interesting is that it was supposed to buy his loyalty, but he keeps doing things we don't want him to do, so apparently he can't be bought.
Yeah, or he can be sort of bought.
He can be sort of bought,
yeah.
Or he's a little bit nuts, which is my personal non-professional psychological analysis of the guy, and goes off.
Well, and I think he's dealing with dueling factions, many of whom would just as soon see him dead, and that's gotta put a dent in your
wears you down.
Mental health, yeah.
Yeah, wears you down. President Obama bid goodbye to Ray LaHood as Transportation Secretary today, calling him possibly the best transportation secretary in history.
And Ray LaHood, a Republican.
Republican. And he's been in the gig since the beginning of President Obama's first term.
So who's going to replace him?
Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox.
And that, and
two exes.
And who is that person?
He is a Democrat, an African-American. He is somebody who has done all kinds of things with transportation in Charlotte. He also was responsible for getting the Democratic convention there,
mm-hmm,
which is when he got to know President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And he's considered a rising star in the Democratic Party.
Great, great.
President Obama didn't want LaHood to step down, actually, and tried to enlist LaHood's wife to get him to stay. But LaHood's wife was the one who wanted him to go.
Oh, well, wrong person to go to then.
So that didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, today, the White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said the administration has no deadline for determining definitively whether Syria has used chemical weapons. So in terms of crossing this red line, he said, what I won't do is speculate about how much time might be required to gather the evidence necessary.
Right. He's going to take as much time as he possibly can, because the last thing, in my personal opinion, the last thing that President Obama wants is to be in the middle of a war in Syria. But
Exactly.
I mean, we already are to a certain extent, but, you know.
Right.
He doesn't want another Iraq or Afghanistan.
NBA Veteran Center Jason Collins has become the first active male professional athlete in the major four American sports leagues to come out as gay today.
Yep.
Very big deal. Wrote a first-person account posted today on Sports Illustrated's website. So far, the response has been very positive.
Yeah, his own team has lauded him. They made a statement that said, we are extremely proud of Jason and support his this is from the Washington Wizards, and support his decision to live his life proudly and openly. He's been a leader on and off the court and an outstanding teammate throughout his NBA career. Those qualities will continue to serve him both as a player and as a positive role model for others of all sexual orientations.
It's interesting because, you know, a few years ago, I'm not sure the reaction would have been this way.
No, I don't think so. Things are changing fast and for the better.
Yeah, yeah. The extraterrestrial hearings at the National Press Club kicked off today with five former U.S. congressmen and one former senator holding them as though they were a mock Senate hearing. They're on the alleged existence of extraterrestrial life and
really?
Subsequent government cover-up, five days of hearing.
Was Dennis Kucinich one of them?
No, he wasn't, actually. And Mike Gravel is the senator.
Oh, Mike Gravel, yeah, okay. Dennis is the only guy I knew of that had, you know, publicly, while he was in office, spoken about his either seeing or believing in UFOs. But, very interesting. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. Stick around. Jeremy Scahill is up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across America, Europe, and the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on the Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide through the Free Speech TV Network. And we are so pleased to have with us Jeremy Scahill, the author of, actually, you can take a full screen, there you go, of Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, New York Times best-selling author of Blackwater. And for our Conversations with Great Minds series, Jeremy, welcome.
I don't know that my mind is that great, but I'm honored to be with you, Tom.
Your mind is that great. And Blackwater was a brilliant book, and you've outdone yourself with Dirty Wars. This is really an extraordinary piece of work.
Thank you.
Let's start out with just the title of the book, Dirty Wars. Why? Why that word? Why that phrase?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't trying to be a master of the obvious. I mean, anyone who's you don't even have to have covered a war to know that all wars are dirty. But I it was sort of a response to the notion that's been put forward by some members of the administration that the Obama administration is somehow waging a clean war, that our drone strikes are just taking out the bad guys, and that the number of civilians killed has sort of been minimal. But what was more important to me about it is, as a kind of reference to a series of dirty wars that you yourself covered extensively and have written about, and that was what the U.S. was doing in Central America in the 1980s,
right,
in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala,
yeah,
where we were getting in bed with right-wing dictatorships, or we were funding, death squads in the form of the Contras, And involved with all sorts of covert action.
In the 50s and 60s in the Middle East.
Right. In the 50s and 60s in the Middle East and in Africa as well. Yeah. I mean, you had the murder of Patrice Lumumba in Congo, and you had the overthrow of Salvador Allende. Yeah. One of the first things the CIA did, of course, was in 54 overthrow Jacobo Arbenz. So, you know, what I think we've seen under President Obama is that he really has tried to get us completely out of Iraq. I mean, there is a residual strike force and a CIA presence, and I'm concerned about that. Afghanistan, he says he's going to draw it down in 2014. But I think what we're going to start seeing is more of this covert action, the small footprint approach. And, you know, we're using warlords in Somalia right now, working with proxy forces in Yemen and elsewhere, and an expansion of robotic warfare, drone warfare.
And that is bad because?
Well, I think that, you know, you can look at it through two lenses. One is you can look at it purely through the perspective of U.S. national security. And what I would say from my experience on the ground in a number of these countries is that we are creating more enemies than we are killing actual terrorists plotting against us. I'm very clear in my book and in my personal life, there are people that want to do harm to the United States, that want to bring down our aircraft or send packages to Jewish community centers. I mean, these plots are real. Hmm. My issue is, if we respond to those threats, which are relatively small compared to many of the threats facing us as a nation, I think our economic situation is and our environmental health, those are two of the major actual security threats facing us. But if you look at what we're doing in the pursuit of a relatively small group of people that want to do harm to us or to kill Americans, I think we're actually increasing the likelihood that such attacks will happen, because I think we're expanding the number of people in countries where these plots could emanate from. So just on a tactical level, I think it's not a good idea. On a bigger level, I think that we are engaged in actions where we are targeting people that we don't actually have any intelligence on. We don't necessarily know their identity. We're classifying them as militants or terrorists based on their age, the region of the country that they live in, and people that they might be in contact with. These things called signature strikes. Mm-hmm. For me, the big issue is going to be blowback and how it's going to harm us.
And may already be, actually, with the it looks like the Boston terrorists or the Boston bombers or whatever you called it, you know, call these guys, that one of them was motivated by our war in Iraq.
Right. And if that turns out to be true, you know, I think it would be part of a pattern that I think we're going to see unfolding more as these wars go on. But I also have to say, a lot of the cable news outlets have been so systematically irresponsible with how they've reported on this story. I mean, clearly, anyone that would do something like that is either a fanatic or a seriously deranged individual, just like the people that go in and shoot up our schools are very deranged. So, it's good to study. It's important to study who these people are. But have we not learned the lesson from what happened after bin Laden was killed, where almost everything John Brennan said turned out to not be true, you know, about bin Laden using his wife as a human shield? But I'm very concerned that we're going to have people with a legitimate score to settle against us trying to attack us in retaliation for a drone strike or something else, and not just because, you know, America is the great Satan, but actually because they have some skin in the game. They've lost family members or been bombed.
The metaphor I was using back in 2002 and 2003 was when the Taliban offered to give bin Laden to a third country for trial and prosecution if the United States would produce any evidence that he had anything to do with 9/11, and we apparently had some evidence or we wouldn't have been calling him out for it, that, you know, we should have done that. We should have said, fine, thanks, we'll take him, you know, shut down his camps. That's, you know, you can go about being the Taliban in Afghanistan. Because this is a country with a GDP of $2 billion a year, you know, a gross domestic product of $2 billion a year. And we're spending like $15, $20 billion, you know, a month, I see. So, you know, this is insane. I mean, this is just plain old flat out insane. And that had we treated 9/11 as a crime done by a deranged criminal and a small sect of a large and noble religion, that large and noble religion, I think, would be with us right now. I mean, there were candlelight vigils in downtown Tehran, Iran, the day after 9/11.
Right.
And we had such an opportunity. And instead, George Bush just turned this thing, this war on terror. And now the Obama administration is, to a certain extent, I mean, he doesn't use the phrase war on terror. I mean, I think he's done
global contingency operations, is what they call it. Right.
He genuinely tried, apparently, to close Guantanamo, and Congress said, no, we won't give you the money to do it. We won't let you do that. These guys are kryptonite, you know, and we're James Inhofe, I'm Superman, and we can't let kryptonite get near Superman. We have created this idea of the war as a battle, or the world is a battlefield. I mean, the subtitle of your book, "The World is a Battlefield."
And that's not my phrase. I mean, that actually was a quote from someone who works on these covert operations. He said, "The world is now a battlefield," and it actually stems from a military doctrine called operational preparation of the battle space, which Donald Rumsfeld really tried to exploit. And that it basically says, if the U.S. military determines that there could be future hostilities in a country around the world, they can forward deploy troops, and there's very minimal oversight of the operations because it's preparing the battle space. And Rumsfeld and Cheney had this vision, as did the neocons, that we can just declare the world a battlefield, and anywhere where terrorists reside, we can go hunt them down and take them out. And the Obama administration has updated and expanded some of those, what were called AQN execute orders, Al-Qaeda network execute orders. And so, you know, in late 2009, when David Petraeus was the commander of CENTCOM, he issued a series of orders that authorized U.S. forces to start striking in Yemen and elsewhere in his area of responsibility. And that's when you saw the Obama administration start bombing it. I also want to say that I think that I don't believe that President Obama is this sort of nefarious villain in his lair plotting to zap up all of the world's resources and steal them. I think that the folks that are running the U.S. counterterrorism operations actually believe that what they're doing is going to keep Americans as safe as possible. I think they've bought into the briefings that they've been presented with by the CIA and by the military, by Admiral McRaven, by the folks that have been at the CIA for a very long time. And I think that President Obama had very little foreign policy experience, and I think he was very, very much seduced by the special ops world because he saw these guys as this incredible elite force. It wasn't even a counterterrorism operation that I think first opened President Obama's eyes to the power of the Joint Special Operations Command. It was when the Maersk Alabama was seized off the coast of Somalia, which was this huge ship that was owned by a defense contractor. And, I mean, you know this history better than I do, but I believe it was the first time that a U.S. flagged vessel had been hijacked in international waters in over 100 years.
Yeah.
And so the SEALs went in and they took down those pirates. And after that, President Obama had Admiral McRaven into the White House. And from there, their relationship was solidified and he started expanding their base of power.
Remarkable. We're talking with Jeremy Scahill, his new book and soon a movie of the same title, right?
That's what I hear.
Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Jeremy Scahill, the book Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. We'll be back with more with Jeremy Scahill right after this. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and Jeremy Scahill is with us for our Conversations with Great Minds this week. His book Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And Jeremy, you were one of the people who revealed the fact that Eric Prince was about to boogie out of town. He was the guy who started Blackwater. I mean, you wrote the book Blackwater, and that he was leaving town. And a rather surprising source, somebody whose name everybody will recognize, shared some of that information with you. Tell us this story.
Yeah, I didn't actually recognize the name of this source at all until well after the fact. And what happened was that we get as journalists, we get emails from people all the time, and some of it is just nutty stuff, and some of it's interesting, and some of it you just don't have time to pursue. But I got this email from a guy. It was a very well-written email and thoughtful, who said that he had a personal connection to someone that had information about the movements of the Prince family, of Eric Prince and his family.
Which is based out of Michigan. They're related to the DeVos family.
Yeah, so the Prince family is Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater. His sister is Betsy DeVos, who, of course, married into the Amway family, the Amway Corporation family.
And basically, he kind of runs or funds the right wing in Michigan.
Party. They bankrolled the groups that would rise to become the radical religious right. Focus on the Family, the Prayer Warrior Network, James Dobson, Gary Bauer. When Eric Prince's dad died, all of those people came to give eulogies at his funeral. I mean, these were the premier bankrollers of what became known as the radical religious right, and they're very, very much in control of a lot of the right-wing politics and politicians in the state of Michigan.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, and you and I have talked about this a lot. In fact, one of my favorite quotes from Blackwater about me came from your show, which is you had the vice president of Blackwater on this show, Martin Strong, and you asked him a question about me, and he said, well, Jeremy Scahill doesn't know anything about Blackwater.
Right.
He said on your show. In any case, I get this email, and it was someone that was very concerned about the idea that Eric Prince was fleeing the country at a time when his company was facing intense investigations from the Congress, from the ATF, from multiple agencies and entities of the federal government and Capitol Hill, and within Capitol Hill. And so I got in touch with this source that he put me in touch with and verified that, in fact, Eric Prince was preparing to leave. Got another source on it, then asked Eric Prince's spokesman to comment on it, and he said, I'm not going to comment on Eric Prince's movements. And then I knew it was there. So we published that story. A couple weeks later, the New York Times follows up on it, and Eric Prince had, in fact, relocated to Abu Dhabi. I think a good year or so went by before I knew who this person was. I got a phone call from someone who was doing research on Bradley Manning, mm-hmm. who of course admitted in his court-martial that he provided WikiLeaks with the hundreds of thousands of diplomatic cables and what's known as the collateral murder video. And he said, I'm reaching out to people who corresponded with Bradley Manning. I said, I didn't correspond with Bradley Manning. And he said, oh, because I've been told that you had. And I said, no, you've been told wrong. And eventually he says to me, well, search your email for, you know, this email address. And I search it. And sure enough, I had been tipped off to Eric Prince leaving the country by Bradley Manning.
That's remarkable.
And what's interesting is no one knew who he was at the time. So I had no reason to remember the name.
Right.
But it was not at all based on classified intelligence. It had nothing to do with his role as an Army intelligence specialist. It was a random personal connection. And I've recently reread that email, and what you know, the tone of it, it's not that short, and it's not too long, but it's not that short. It seems like someone who was truly concerned about the idea that someone whose company was involved with all of this death and destruction was potentially trying to leave so that the federal investigators couldn't question him or wouldn't be able to hold that company accountable. And
to what extent has Eric Prince done that? Has he gotten out of the country and gotten out of trouble?
Well, he appears to be completely out of trouble. I think that's very unjust, particularly to the not only the Iraqi victims of Blackwater, but to the taxpayers. You know, these guys made tens of millions of dollars off their domestic operations in New Orleans after Katrina, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars off of Iraq and Afghanistan. Eric Prince was just in New York, I understand, a few days ago attending the Tribeca Film Festival because there's a movie that's been made about his vision for a counter-piracy force in Somalia. So, he lives pretty much under the protection of the lovely democratic royals of the United Arab Emirates and, you know, lives in a place where a lot of the war contracting business operates now in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. And
no charges against him, but the five people under him were indicted on federal conspiracy charges and weapons charges, and they were given 4 months of house arrest.
Remarkable.
You know, Bradley Manning is in prison. John Kiriakou is in prison, the former CIA operative who talked about torture. Thomas Drake, former NSA analyst, is now working at an Apple store because they ruined him for blowing the whistle on warrantless wiretapping. And Eric Prince is having movies made about him and attending the Tribeca Film Festival. I mean, it really says a lot about the state of justice in this war counterterrorism world.
Yeah, yeah, it really does. Back to Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield.
And Prince is in this book, too, Eric Prince, about his actions in Somalia, but we can save that for another time.
Very interesting. Yeah, we just have a minute here to the break. What is the legal basis that President Obama uses to drop a drone on somebody?
That cuts to the heart of what question a lot of Americans should be asking. Right now, if a reporter asks the White House, they'll send you a boilerplate memo about how the original authorization for the use of military force that was passed by the Congress in 2001 during a climate of fear
after 9/11
that gave right after 9/11 and set this sort of standard that anyone that's even remotely attached to the 9/11 attacks can become a legitimate target for the use of military force. Right now, some of the people being targeted under that authorization were toddlers when 9/11 happened. So, you know, if you can look at that and say, well, you know, yeah, I guess that there's sort of a rationale there. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is attached to Al-Qaeda and therefore is attached to 9/11. But really, at the end of the day, even if the AOMF was repealed, President Obama, what they really do is they assert the right under Article 2 of the Constitution to conduct the foreign policy and military operations as commander-in-chief. And that's what Cheney and Bush relied on also when pressed on the AUMF.
Wow.
It's an Article 2 justification.
This is exactly what James Madison warned us against in his famous speech about the danger of the executive branch and a state of perpetual war. He said, you know, democracy cannot exist in a state of perpetual war. It's amazing. Jeremy Scahill.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Jeremy Scahill is with us. Our conversation is with the great minds today. His new book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Go out and get a copy now. We'll be back with more of Jeremy in about... Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Place where smart people get their news. Speaking of smart people, Jeremy Scahill in the room with us, one of the smartest people I know.
Tom, I was saying to you before we came on the air, that I don't know of anyone else who's done more to put the current context or the current situation that we're in into historical context. I mean, there's so much ding battery that's floating around Washington these days. It's seriously, I don't. It's like people don't study history.
Yes.
Every crisis is new. Everything in war is new. Everything with the Tea Party is new. No, yeah. It's not. There's all of this has historical precedent in this country, and we don't study history in any kind of an effective way in this country.
I think, you know, it may be an apocryphal quote, but it's usually attributed to Arnold Toynbee, that when the man who remembers the horrors, when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable.
Right.
And it's just...
Given what's happening now.
Yeah, it really is. I'm curious. We're talking with Jeremy Scahill. His new book is Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And I'm curious your thoughts on what's going on in Syria right now. The president is doing this dance. I was talking with Victoria Jones about it in the newscast just before you came on. He has drawn this red line in the sand. You know, if they use nerve gas, then we're gonna go in and take them out. Well, apparently they've used nerve gas, and now he's saying, well, we're not sure, and we're going to think about it for a while. And, you know, it's really obvious he doesn't want another Iraq. What are your thoughts on the whole Syria situation?
Well, I mean, I think that the Assad regime is a brutal dictatorship, and it was a brutal dictatorship when the Bush administration was simultaneously calling it part of the Axis of Evil and, using it when extraordinary rendition was convenient.
Yeah.
The U.S. plays both sides of all sorts of issues in the Middle East and other places around the world. I think, though, that we are seeing, in a way, Iraq war redux on the chemical weapons issues and others. I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm saying that I think we haven't seen concrete evidence yet that the threat is as serious as it's being presented. It very well could be, and I think it should be confronted. Any nation that is going to actually be using chemical, nuclear, biological weapons should have to face consequences. Should those consequences be military invasion by the United States and a coalition of its allies? I mean, these are oftentimes fool's errands when we go on them. We say that we're intervening for humanitarian purposes, and then we get embroiled in these wars that oftentimes end up making things worse. So I'm concerned about the calls for the U.S. to intervene. In my sort of realm of what I follow, I would look for the U.S. is going to start doing more covert actions inside of Syria. You know, the Nusra Front.
Which we're doing.
There already is covert action on the ground. So what I'm saying is I don't think that the Obama administration is going to get overtly involved in a military campaign against Syria anytime soon, the way that we did when we helped to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi with U.S.
Right.
air support and support for the rebels on the ground. The problem is that the Free Syrian Army and the Nusra Front, all of these different groups are not necessarily on the same side. And some of them are groups that have an affiliation with or affinity for Al-Qaeda.
Right. Nor are they on our side.
Right. So I think that's what, if you talk to people who are monitoring this for U.S. intelligence agencies and the military, they're very concerned about us ending up piping in covert funding or finance arms to people that will then turn out to use it to attack U.S. interests.
Right.
I don't think we fully understand what happened at Benghazi. This, unfortunately, has become this kind of cuckoo realm of the far
right
about Benghazi, this idea that there was this massive cover-up. But I don't think there's actually been a thorough investigation of, was that blowback? Were there actions that were being conducted that resulted in that consular office being laid to siege? I don't know. But I think we need to look at what's happened in Libya and be very careful about how we respond to Syria, and also not to fall for propaganda that could be put out by other nations that have their own agenda or other forces within the Syrian opposition. So
sure.
I think there's a lot we don't know, and we have to be careful in how we approach
it. Is there some sort of reasonable middle ground, like, for example, the civilians are taking the brunt of this in Syria, and an awful lot of it's coming from the air. The no-fly zone in Iraq, while Saddam still took tanks up into the north. In fact, a very good friend of mine took 34 bullets to his car right after George Herbert Walker Bush said he was going to kick a little Baghdad butt declared the no-fly zone. And Horst von Heyer was there doing relief work for an organization that I work with in the Kurdistan, in that northern region. And he just sent his military up there.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the southern no-fly zone in the 90s.
Okay,
yeah,
so you know. But it was effective at least reducing the level of carnage that Saddam was capable of. And might that be a middle ground? Is that the camel's nose under the tent that's just inevitable? You're going to end up with the whole camel.
I mean, the thing is about no-fly zones just to talk about it on a tactical level, thing about no-fly zones is that it's not just like you set a rule and then say, if your aircraft are there, we're going to take you out. That means putting in your own aircraft to patrol the skies, and it would probably mean a preemptive strike campaign against the air defense capability of Syria. So no-fly zones aren't necessarily like a nonviolent approach where the threat is on the table, and if they come at you, you take them out. The U.S. would probably, or it's most likely they would use another country to do it, maybe another NATO country, go in and take out their air defenses. I mean, unfortunately, the Arab
League...
Would
that be a bad thing?
Well, I mean, I think that's the perspective that's put forward by people like Anne Marie Slaughter, who now is going to be she's the Princeton professor, former senior official at the State Department. I think we would need a whole hour to discuss this, but I ultimately don't think that no-fly zones work, and I think that the people within them end up paying the price. I think that the intent is noble, but I think that the reality on the ground often is that the civilians who we say we're protecting end up being the ones getting hit.
Isn't there a certain level of kind of hubris and what's the word where a nation is? Empire. Yeah. Of hubris and empire.
You said the E word.
Yeah. With this idea that, you know, we can solve all the problems of the world. And by the way, we're going to ignore Robert Mugabe because, you know, the principal product of Zimbabwe is rutabagas or something. I mean, they don't have any oil. But, you know.
Well, somebody said if we had olive oil instead of, you know, petrol, you know.
Exactly.
Well,
on the one hand, you could argue we should just let them sort this stuff out themselves. And then on the other hand, you say, well, you know, we could have said that during World War II about, you know, Hitler, too. And, you know, there has to be a point at which you say enough.
So, I mean, it's interesting. I remember when I was in Yugoslavia in the 90s during the bombing of Serbia over the issue of Kosovo.
Yeah.
That year, the Turkish government was using hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. military aid to turn weapons on its own people, on the Kurds of Turkey, and they were waging a genocidal campaign against the Kurds at a time when we went to war against Serbia, supposedly to stop the ethnic cleansing of Albanians in Kosovo. I mean, history is full of examples where the U.S. will intervene when it feels that its interests are at stake, and very seldom intervenes purely for purely humanitarian means. You know this history better than anyone, too, Tom. The history of World War II. The United States was on the wrong side when fascism was on the rise in Europe. If the U.S. had joined with the anti-fascists who very early on saw the threat that was being posed, the Franco rebellion, when Hitler first started posturing against Poland, the U.S. was not on the right side of history at that moment. Yeah. So
you had the entire Republican Party in the United States. I mean, probably the most widely published author in the world at that time was Rex Stout.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this book called The Illustrious Dunderheads in 1946, which is just a collection of speeches on the floor of the House and Senate by virtually all Republicans or a few Democrats. Saying, oh, Hitler's not such a bad guy. We shouldn't go into the war. FDR wants to go into a war so he can become a dictator. Pardon my interrupting you.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's you know, sometimes those of us who argue against some of these wars that are portrayed as being humanitarian get World War II thrown in our face.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'll take that question on and legitimately and discuss what I think is a legitimate part of that question. And I don't mean that you did this, but oftentimes those people forget that are presenting that challenge forget that the United States totally ignored or supported, or its corporations or politicians supported, the rise of fascism in Europe. And, so if you want to just cherry pick and say, well, wasn't the U.S. right to intervene because of the slaughter of millions upon millions of Jewish people by Hitler and others, you know, gay people, Roma people, I mean, the list goes on and on. Yeah. It's such a selective reading of history. Mm-hmm. And in order to understand what should we intervene in Syria or not, let's look at the whole historical context and let's look at the level of slaughter in Syria relative to regimes around the world that we've been financing, supporting, bolstering. I mean, let's be clear. The U.S. would intervene in Syria militarily if it believed it was in its geostrategic interest, not just because it's the humanitarian thing to do.
2 years ago, we did our show from the Darfur border in South Sudan. 500 miles.
Now, where is that? Is that somewhere in is that a province in Afghanistan?
No,
of course I do. Yeah. It's just, it's
and that's the thing. It was 500 miles from the nearest road, 500 miles from the nearest electricity. They had not yet figured out that there was oil there. Now, actually, it was about 4 years ago we did a show. Now the Chinese are crawling all over the country, you know, pulling the oil out and cutting deals.
Remember when Bill Richardson, when he was running for president for the nomination, Democratic Party, he said at one of the debates that, you know, we could get the slaughter to stop in Darfur by threatening to cut off raw metal exports to the Chinese government. He said something that was too smart for, you know, cable television. Yeah. But his point was, the U.S. could use its tremendous economic leverage to force China and Russia's hand at various times, and it chooses not to do so.
Particularly with regard to northern Sudan, with the Bashir government.
Look, I mean, China controls a huge percentage of the Sudanese oil market and has a lot of leverage with that government. So if we can encourage China to do more, I'm just saying this is all fifth dimensional chess. Military solution should not be the first option on the table, and I don't think the U.S. should intervene in Syria. I do think there are other ways of confronting governments that do these things. But we shouldn't be the cops of the world.
There you go. Jeremy Scahill, Dirty Wars. The world is a
battlefield. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Jeremy, thanks so much for being with us.
It was a real honor to be with you, Tom.
The book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, Jeremy Scahill. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Candy in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Candy, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I really always learn a lot when I listen to your program. My question was, you know, I tend to agree with you and your guest about taking troops into Syria or getting more involved in that war, because we don't understand what the different groups are. But my question is, you know, why is McCain so eager to take us in there? What does he hear, or, you know, why would he? I don't understand.
You know, John McCain during the Vietnam War was basically playing a video game. He was dropping bombs from the sky, so he never saw the death and carnage that his bombs caused. He was playing this video game, and then he was made a prisoner of war for, 4 or 5 years, whatever it was, 6 years. And during that time, I have to believe that he experienced extraordinary trauma and stress. And I think between the guilt of the former, the dissociative and mentally destructive action of the following torture, and then you know, he came back here and he married a woman who is worth hundreds of millions of dollars and has basically everything. I think he's just a very, very damaged man, and he thinks somehow that war is a solution. And I think that there's, at some level, a part of John McCain that wants, because he was involved in Vietnam, wants Vietnam to have been a good war, like World War II was, you know, a good war in quotes. And he keeps looking for the good war. He really wants to be the good warrior. And there is no such thing as a good war. You know, there's just wars that are crap. I mean, there's just wars that are just dirty. They're terrible. People die in wars. Wars are organized and legalized murder. They are insane. They are the most insane dimension of humanity is warfare, so that's my guess on why McCain has become such a war hawk. Because when you talk to people like Chuck Hagel, for example, or John Kerry, who were actually on the ground in Vietnam,
and they saw the consequences of those bombs that John McCain was dropping, or that the North Vietnamese were dropping, who saw people have their limbs blown off, people who died in front of them, who carried bloody bodies, who themselves were fired at and wounded in the case of John Kerry. When you talk to those guys, or Colin Powell, you know, who saw the real consequences of war, right up close and personal, they tend not to be the war hawks. The war hawks typically are people who have no military service whatsoever, or if they did have military service, it was of a very unique type. You know, they were behind a desk, they were someplace else, or, as I said, in the case of John McCain, I think he was basically playing a video game until he got busted, and then he spent a couple of years in a hole, and it has, I think, you know, twisted his mind. So anyway, my thoughts on that. Candy, thank you. I need to get some more callers in here before we wrap up the show. Candy, thank you for the call. Thanks so much. Scott in Seattle, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm having a little problem hearing you, but I'll keep. I think I still got you on the line.
Yeah, I'm here.
I was just thinking about the Syria thing. I think Barack Obama's doing a pretty smart job of it. I think he's kind of, you know, he kind of took the lead when he said, hey, if this gets out of hand, you know, we're going to have to do something about it. But then I think, you know, being Syria, it's kind of Russia's area, right? They're Syria's Russia's puppet. So he's kind of letting them maybe take some solving measures.
Well, I think he's hoping that Russia will do something about it. You know, I am no Syria expert, which is why I wanted to ask Jeremy Scahill. You can ask me pretty much anything about domestic politics or economics, and I can take a good shot at answering it. But international relations is an area that is so specialized and is so detailed and requires such study and is so nuanced and subtle. And there are so many different dimensions of it, you know, and ways to view it that I tend not to make proclamations or even pretty much go there on this program. As you've probably noticed, this program is far more focused on domestic issues. But I think that my personal sense is that Barack Obama is doing everything he can to avoid having Syria turn into Afghanistan or Iraq. That he does not want to, or Libya for that matter, he does not want to repeat that. And, you know, whether that's a good thing or not, history is going to have to tell us. You know, this is something we're going to know in retrospect, and I'm not going to be the guy to second-guess him. Thanks a lot for the call, Scott. Brian in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Hey, Brian, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
I love your work, and I love your show.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment on the John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, actually, that when he first was shot down, he was tortured and beaten up by the people who he was dropping bombs on.
Yeah.
But when he was taken captive, when they learned that his father was an admiral, a big shot in the Navy, they treated him with a fair amount of respect. So I don't think he was tortured too brutally for the entire 4 or 5 years he was a...
I have heard that story as well, and you know, we'll never know. It probably is true. He seems to have survived it in ways that other prisoners of war who came back didn't. When you look at the number of how overrepresented Vietnam War veterans are among the homeless population, among the mentally ill population in the United States, among the mentally ill homeless subset of that population in the United States, it's startling. And so it may well be that McCain was spared some of the worst of what could have been offered him because his dad was an admiral. Brian, thanks for the call. Lynn, in John Day, Oregon, we have just a few seconds left. Quick comment.
Well, I come from a gun-owning family, and I support background checks for guns, and also for true sportsmen. The main thing is habitat loss.
Yeah.
And the NRA does absolutely nothing to focus on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Lynn, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, the latest news and information on the sequester cuts, Republican austerity, plus how about taxing the Internet? I'll challenge Libertarian Wayne Allen Root, author of the new book, The Ultimate Obama Survival Guide, that and the best of the rest of the news, along with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, occupy something, tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.